Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink. A little later, we're going to have Brock Schwartzel, the Court of Appeals judge, who is running for the Supreme Court, joining us. And also Ron Bieber, the president of the AFL-CIO. Happy Labor Day. It's the Labor Day weekend edition of the MERS Monday podcast. And John, as we kind of head into the meat of September, I think September is going to be looking a little different than what we're used to, and not just because of COVID-19. I have a suspicion that the campaign is going to really be starting in earnest for president, U.S. Senate, Congress, just about everything right now.
I think I would agree with you. I think it's going to be the next 45 days. I've been reading a lot of coverage. I think this week one of the major papers had an analysis of states where you have to worry about, if you're going to mail-in vote, getting it done early, as early as you can. And Michigan was one of those states, arguably because of the law that we have that they can't count ballots that come in after 8 p.m. On election day. But I think I've talked to pollsters. We had a roundtable with pollsters earlier this summer, and they all concluded a lot of the voting is going to be done in the first week of October. So a lot of the decisions are being, if you're not already decided, a lot of the decisions are being made this month that we're in.
And you can just take a look at the ad spending we're seeing for Gary Peters, John James, Paul Young, who is running for the 8th Congressional District, already has his ad up. Alyssa Slotkin already has two ads up. And that was before Labor Day. And typically, campaigns waited until Labor Day. We're seeing that crawl now. And the reason is because of exactly what you're saying. People are going to be getting their ballots earlier. They're going to be making up their minds earlier because they want to turn in their ballots earlier because they are worried about the post office and whether something's going to get into their door. How does that change campaigns, do you think? How are they going to be doing things differently than they have in years past?
I'm wondering if we're going to see, well, I've already started to get some text messages from candidates, unsolicited calls from candidates. I'm also wondering if we're going to see a lot more postcards starting the next couple of weeks going in the mail, because so many people aren't going to answer the door to somebody they don't know, or if they do, they're going to be very hesitant to have a long conversation with them. And you can't really do door-to-door in the traditional sense. So I'm really curious to see if we're going to have a pickup in mail, which is also going to complicate the returns of ballots vis-a-vis the mail. So it's going to be interesting 40 days, 45 days.
Well, and, you know, I'm thinking about the primary, and I got a piece of mail from a candidate right on primary election day. And I think that was after I'd even shown up at the polls. I mean, my mail doesn't come until like 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd already shown up to the polls. And for candidates are going to have to be thinking ahead like that as well. I mean, they're going to need to get their mail pieces out to hit in mid-September or something like that, because even if you wait until late October, when a lot of the heavy dirt starts flying, it's going to be too late for a lot of these campaigns.
Yeah, you'd really want to have your stuff at the printer already probably this week.
Which is
beginning of next week.
Which is completely different. And it's also got to kind of change the strategy a little bit for, you know, the big candidates. And in this case, Joe Biden, President Donald Trump. Let's start with Donald Trump. What do you think the odds are that he comes to Michigan and does one of his rallies at some point? Better than 50-50?
It's probably 50. It's probably 50% declining. I think they're increasingly realizing that Michigan is out of reach for him. So I wouldn't be surprised if we kind of get ignored if that continues, because he's got more states he's got to fight in. There are states he won that he's now there's real questions about whether he can carry him. Florida, Ohio, they say statistically he's probably got a better chance there than Florida. You know, Wisconsin's always close. That's why he was there, probably there today. So I wouldn't be surprised if Michigan kind of gets dropped off the end of the list.
It's interesting to look at the ad spending that we're seeing in the presidential race, and kudos to Simon Schuster, our old MERS colleague here now at the Campaign Finance Network, digging into the numbers and seeing how much money is being spent. And just taking a look at how much money the Joe Biden campaign has already committed, $24 million with issues and other supporting groups committing $29.5 million. So we're already over $50 million on the Democratic side. And then you take a look at President Trump and Republicans, and it's less than half. They're crossing the $20 million range, while Biden is at the $50 million range. So we're already seeing it here with these numbers, John, that it almost seems like Michigan's becoming a stretch goal for Trump and the Republicans.
Yeah, and if you're Laura Cox, if you're John James, if you're Jason Wentworth in the House, State House, you've got to be really concerned about what's going on with that spending level, if that will even be, if what's been reserved will even be spent.
Yeah, I mean, that's, and, you know, John James has got a deep pocket, so he's going to be able to stay afloat with Gary Peters and kind of go blow for blow with him for a while. But, you know, Gary Peters has nine different committees that are working on his behalf. John James has five right now, but Peters has got the advantage when it comes to outside groups spending. So if this becomes a spending war, I have a feeling that while John James is doing amazingly well fundraising for his own, that Peters just has more aerial support to help him on the airwaves.
Yep, and if he can tie him closely to Trump, that Biden advertising, denigrating Trump across the board will help Peters.
You know, one thing about, you mentioned Jason Wentworth here just a minute ago. He's the presumed next Republican leader, presuming that the Republicans keep majority. You know, I'm still struck by that interview that we had a couple podcasts ago with Brian Biegun from Grassroots Midwest, who helped draw the maps for the Republicans. And the fact that these maps were drawn to keep a Republican majority into this particular cycle, the 2020 cycle. And then last week, of course, we had Sam Singh, the former minority leader, in, and he even conceded that, you know, it sounded like from him, 57 seats was what he thought was kind of the ceiling. Like 60 would be amazing, but I mean, realistically, he was only thinking 57. And so when you're looking at these deep divides and these in these state house districts and these base levels, I'm telling you, John, it does look like if these numbers hold out that this is going to come down to very tight races and very specific districts. And some of these other districts that are kind of on the fringe only are in play if there's some kind of wave.
Well, I'm still rooting for 55-55 because I'd love to see it happen and cover it. And for journalists, it would be great. I'm sure the Republicans wouldn't like it. The Democrats would like it because it's at least an improvement over what they got. But it would be fun to cover, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be really interesting to see what happens. You know, the first question that you would have to ask is, does everybody hold? Because the first question that will be decided for this legislature, if it is 55-55, is who's going to be the Speaker of the House. And we remember the shared gavel with Hertel and Hilligans, but the one before that, John, back in the 50s, it was not like that at all. And we actually had a Democrat flip and vote for a Republican for Speaker, and that got really nasty. And that could happen again.
Well, it could happen again, because remember, we're in the era of term limits. The loyalty to the party leadership is not necessarily what it used to be back in the day. When you were expecting to have a 20-year, 15-year career working with the same group of Democrats, you're in and you're out. If you're on your final term, and you think you can get something really good by flipping, there's going to be a lot of jockeying going on if that takes place, and that'll be fun to cover too.
Yeah. So if you're a Democrat and you're kind of on the outs, I'm thinking maybe Karen Whitsitt. I don't know if she would do anything like this, but if the Republicans said, "Hey, you vote for Jason Wentworth for Speaker, and you can become the approach chair or chair of something else," It would be hard to turn that down.
It would be.
All right. We're going to be talking with Brock Schwartzel a little later here. But before that, I wanted to talk about the Supreme Court race in general. So Mary Roy Kelly is an assistant prosecutor in St. Clair County, or she was. She's got a different post with the court right now. Is not won an election before. She's only run one other time for a local judgeship, was not successful. And yet, is it fair to say, John, that she is the favorite with Bridget McCormick going into this race solely based on the fact that her name is Mary Kelly?
Probably. We're going to talk about that a little bit, I'm sure, with Brock. But that Kelly name is something, and I always get back to it. I raised it before. When voters who don't know judges go in, they're sort of relying on old names, and they kind of equate it maybe to Frank Kelly certainly other counties that have ran and successfully been elected. So yeah, I would think so, just on the name alone.
Isn't that something else?
Maybe Brock should go with Brock O'Schwartzel. Brock O'Schwartzel.
Yeah, that's, yeah. I don't know if that would fool people or not, but I mean, you bring up a great point, because you take a look at the people who tend to have success on the court. We've got a McCormick, we've got a Kavanaugh, and Mary Beth Kelly served before, Marilyn Kelly served before.
Frank Kelly on the AG side, but still that name.
Yeah, I mean, we addressed this with Elizabeth Welsh last week, and I think she understands it too, and particularly, you know, with there being no Republican-Democrat designation on the ballot. Not that that can't be overcome, though. I'm thinking back toward the sleeping judge race there that Mark Brewer pulled off back in, what was that, 2008, when they were able to knock off Cliff Taylor. So it can be done. I'm going to be curious to see if the party, the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, put a lot of resources in to try and raise the name ID for either Brock Schwartzel or on the Republican side or on the Democratic side, Elizabeth Welsh.
Well, I think the other problem that I don't see either party stepping up to spend a lot of time like they did with sleeping judge. There's too many fires. I mean, there's too much passion at the presidential level. There's too much angst going on. I think there's too much excitement on the Democratic side about the prospects of maybe getting the state house back. There's a lot of other places they're going to put their resources.
But how about that, though, John? Because think about this. The Supreme Court right now is 4-3 in favor of Republican-nominated judges, and the Democrats could flip it if Elizabeth Welsh is able to win that seat with Bridget McCormick, who I think we presume is going to win. Wouldn't that be something else, though? Because you would think, you know, in the years of Mark Brewer, that would be like a top priority. But it's as if, though, that court has become less partisan over the years, has become so less divisive, that the Democrats aren't going to put that kind of effort in.
The Democrats have a court that they're probably not too terribly upset with.
Right, exactly.
I mean, the conservative
right.
business community doesn't like this court. But in a way, when you talk to them, you sometimes get a sense that they've given up on it, that it's gone, that it's something of the past, that you're not going to see the huge spending we saw when they were building that court back in the era of John Engler and a little bit after. It kind of feels like that moment's passed.
All right. Well, we'll talk with Brock Schwartzel about that now. We'll go ahead and bring him in. Brock Schwartzel, Court of Appeals Judge. Join us now for the podcast is Court of Appeals Judge Brock Schwartzel. He just got nominated by the Michigan Republican Party to run for the Michigan Supreme Court. He's joining us now. How you doing, Brock?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. All right. So tell us about running for the Supreme Court. And you know, obviously, this is about name recognition. How do you get people to vote for a Brock Schwartzel for Supreme Court?
I think by getting the word out about my experience and my vision for the court. That's really the only way to do it, is just to continuously put yourself forward to the public, and hopefully word of mouth will carry quite a ways. But, you know, we have the campaign team has a good plan for getting the name out there. And luckily, at least in the 4th district, which is, you know, 1/4 of the state, I've been on the ballot already, so you know I have some name recognition in that area. So I think combined, you know, name recognition, word of mouth, digital presence, I think that's going to help carry us through to November.
I'll ask you the same question I asked our previous Supreme Court candidate, and that is: as you're sort of looking at running for this position, one of the things I've always thought a lot about is a lot of my neighbors don't know their local judge, let alone the Court of Appeals judges or the Supreme Court judges. Should we be appointing our Supreme Court justice?
That's one way to handle it. And certainly that's what happens when a judge or justice leaves before the end of their term. I think electing judges and justices works. I like Michigan's system. I think it's up to the judges and justices to get our names out there and to answer questions and to go on podcasts like this to get our names out there. And that's certainly something that I've embraced. I am doing the very best I can to get my name in front of voters, let them know the vision I have for the Supreme Court. And if they agree with me, great. I hope they support me. If they don't share my vision, then voters need to do their own education to figure out who they support.
Obviously, there's no party designation with Supreme Court. What's important is name, ID, and incumbency designation. But it's still voter turnout by the party that nominated you makes a difference. Are you at all concerned that the president's kind of been absent? There's questions how much they'll spend in Michigan.
No, I think anybody who says that they have a firm understanding of what's going to happen in November, I think just, you know, I don't know that I believe them, because this is an election cycle unlike any I've seen, you know, certainly since I've been paying attention to politics. And so I think things change on a daily basis. And again, my job is to get my name out there, get my vision out there, and hopefully educate as many voters as I can reach. That's my job, and that's what I'm going to focus on. You know, what else happens, that's out of my control.
So you were nominated as a rule of law judge. What does that mean, rule of law?
I think it's somebody who applies and interprets the law as it's written, who looks at a statute and doesn't try to fix the statute or try to divine what the legislature might have been thinking when it passed that statute. It's somebody who simply reads the words and applies them as written.
And so as you look at judges out there, obviously you are one now, but as you look at ones maybe in the federal level who have a lot of experience, who do you admire the most?
My old boss, David McKeague. He is somebody who I have tried to emulate over the years. I worked for him for 5 years total, 1 year at the trial court level and 4 years at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. It's fair to say that the vision that I bring to the court is very, very similar to the vision that he brings to his court.
How about at the Supreme Court level? Is there any Supreme Court justices that you tend to like?
It's probably no surprise to say Antonin Scalia is somebody who, whenever I read one of his opinions, it always is both entertaining and makes sense. And so that's certainly someone who I've tried to emulate. I try to, in my writing, be both interesting and logical, and I hope that I achieve that.
So a lot of our listeners are folks that you worked with when you were with the Speaker of the House. Tell us what it's been like to be a Court of Appeals judge. How has life changed for you since you joined the court?
It really slowed down in the way that I'm used to. I clerked for federal courts for 7 years. And so I was used to that very methodical way of looking at the law, having a lot of time to read cases, to read the record, to really get a firm understanding of exactly what was happening in a particular case. The legislature was a much faster institution to be a part of. It's just, you know, the speed of which things are thrown at you is just, it's accelerated compared to the judiciary. And so I think, I really enjoy being at the Court of Appeals. I certainly enjoyed my time in the legislature. But in terms of, you know, where I see myself for the next 20, 30 years of my career, it's certainly in the judiciary. It's what I've loved, and it's what I feel most comfortable with.
I wonder if you talk a little bit about even sort of the nominating process and working towards it. You had to do it in the middle of this pandemic. Talk a little bit for our listeners about what that was like, the challenges that maybe were unique.
I've been told that this was a much different nomination process. Now, this is the first one I've gone through, so to me, this is the normal. But talking with others, this is a very, very different process. It's, a lot of it, not shockingly, is being done by phone and by Zoom conferences. I've been lucky in that I have a lot of pre-existing relationships through my time in the legislature. And so when I'm calling supporters, a lot of them are folks that we dealt with either back, you know, back in the legislature in one way, shape, or form, same as financial supporters. So I've been lucky in that respect that I have a lot of those pre-existing relationships. With that said, it's been harder. You know, you can't get out and have the in-person meetings that you've been able to do in the past. So, you know, we've been doing our best to make do, everyone else.
Has anybody brought up to you, hey, you're one of the guys who helped get rid of Gamrat and Courser?
You know, that has not come up once.
Is that right?
No.
Isn't that kind of amazing? I mean, that was only like 5 years ago and dominated headlines and got national media, and you were neck deep in that whole thing.
You know, I think it was the two representatives who everyone remembers. I think everyone else was a bit player.
I think you're underestimating yourself on that one there. I mean, you were right there with Tom Leonard and Kevin Cotter and... Oh my gosh! I mean, so people don't really bring that up. That's just not something that comes up in the course of conversation.
No, you know, maybe it's the fact that we're in a pandemic. You know, everybody's focused on, you know, the stay-at-home orders, whether schools are going to be in person or not in person. You know, whether barbers are going to be allowed to cut hair. That's what everybody has just been focused on. At least from what I've been able to see.
And you've played a part of that as well, being the dissenting opinion on that case involving the legislature and suing the governor over the 1945 law. What kind of response have you gotten on that, your dissent in that case?
I think it's been a good response from across the spectrum of partisan views. You know, the point I tried to make in my dissent was that this case needed to be heard on an accelerated time frame, but it needed a full appeal. It needed full briefing. It needed to have a 3-judge panel pulled from all 25 judges, not just the motion panel, which is 3 judges out of this district. So, you know, my point was, these issues are maybe the most important issues that this, the legal issues at play here are maybe the most interesting, important legal issues that this state has faced in 30, 40, 50 years. I mean, it goes to the very bedrock of our constitutional form of government, the separation of powers. And I just think, you know, my point was we needed to handle this in a more methodical fashion. So, and I think that's happening now, and I'm grateful to see that. I think it's going to get a full and fair airing in front of the Supreme Court, I think next week, and it'll be interesting to see what they do with it.
How long do you think we're going to have to wait? Just spitball. Are we talking weeks or months?
I hope weeks, but I really don't have any particular insight. I hope weeks. These issues have been debated all throughout the summer. I don't know that we're going to come up with any particularly new brilliant ideas. They're out there. They've been circulating. I think it's just, you know, the justices are going to have to vote and put out their opinions.
We got a minute left. Anything else you want to say about your candidacy here for the Supreme Court?
I want people to be engaged. I want them to do their research on judges and justices. I want them to take a look at our experience, and I think when they do, I think I'll have a fair amount of support. I hope that my experience and vision for the Supreme Court is what people are attracted to, and I ask for everyone's support on November 3rd.
All right, Brock Schwartzel, Court of Appeals judge and the Republican-nominated candidate for the Michigan Supreme Court. Thank you so much for taking some time with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school.
Joining us now is the president of the AFL-CIO here in the state of Michigan, Ron Bieber. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
We'd like having you on Labor Day to give us an update on how labor is doing in the state of Michigan. And this has got to be a very challenging time for the working men and women of the state of Michigan right now.
It is challenging. We've got a lot of people who are out of work, and, it's scary. It's a scary time. We've got a lot of union members who are frontline workers who are worried about this COVID and being, going to work. And mostly everything I've heard from is they're worried about bringing it back to their families. But there's an awful lot of people, especially union workers, who aren't at work because they happen to be in industries that, aren't allowed to be functioning now, especially like hospitality and workers who work in those kinds of fields. But, it's Labor Day, and this is a working people's holiday. It's time for us to celebrate the contribution that workers make to the economy and to our communities. And for organized labor, we never forget that it was strong labor unions that created the middle class in this country. And we're proud of that, and we celebrate that on Labor Day. So it's a good time for us all to take a minute and reflect on the sacrifices that was made by all those who came before us and laid the path for all that we have today. And it's a good time for us to take a second and honor that rich history of the past by committing all of us to do the work of today to move working people's agenda forward.
One of the things that is going on right now in the legislature because of COVID-19 are the tort bills that give exemptions to facilities, nursing homes, nonprofits, hospitals, in case somebody dies under their care because of COVID-19. And that's been something I know that the labor unions are concerned about. What would you like to see from the legislature in regards to any type of bill dealing with tort? Because there is a concern that hospitals could suffer big losses if an employee comes after them and says, I got COVID-19 on the job and it's your fault.
Well, here's what I think, Kyle. You can't take a person and put them in a position where they don't have any recourse if wrong is done to them. The good employers, the good facilities, I think they're doing the right thing. And they're, they're protecting workers, they're protecting customers, they're protecting the people in the hospitals who come in to take care of them. But you can't blanketly say there's liability for everyone. It'll drive the wrong behavior, in my mind. It'll drive a behavior that says we don't have to worry about it. We can cut corners and we can do things that might not protect people the way that they should be doing. Your good employers are doing a great job, and they're making sure that protections in there are for workers to be safe and to not catch this virus, to not take it home to their families. But you can't put legislation or policy in place, in my opinion, that across the board gives a license to not do the right thing.
Now, the legislature did move something to the governor's office. She did veto that. It looks like they're trying again with another bill. Are you getting the sense that they're working more with the Democrats, the Republicans are, on this particular bill, or are they trying to do kind of the same thing?
The liability for businesses? I think they're going to pass it. I think they're going to pass it and probably send it to the governor. I don't understand it. I don't understand why you would want to put people at risk, especially, everybody knows what these frontline people did, the nurses and the people in the grocery stores. I would, when this virus first started, I had a mask, I had gloves, I had anything I could think of to try and protect myself. And you go in there and here were these cashiers, and that was before they even put in the plexiglass and stuff, or bangers or whatever in the grocery stores. I would have been scared to death to be in there doing those jobs. And yet these people did it. They did it to take care of us. And we've got to do everything we can to take care of them. The way the nurses were treated, in my mind, was terrible, horrible. Lack of PPE. Every day it seemed like I was getting calls from unions that represent nurses and just begging for help for PPE for their workers. And, that's crazy. We should have never been in a position like that.
Now that we've been in this for 6 months, what are you hearing? Is it three quarters of employers are fine? There's a quarter that's bad. are most employers providing the protective equipment that they should be, providing the environmental cleaning they should be? Talk to our listeners a little bit about what you're hearing.
Well, it's the bigger companies that I hear the most about, and by and large, I think they're doing a great job. You don't hear much problems coming from the bigger companies. It's the smaller companies that we don't hear about, and a lot of those may not have a union in there to represent them, right? So I'm afraid myself that there's a lot of stuff going on out there where workers aren't protected in these smaller companies where, you know, they don't have a union that they can go and talk to and are worried about reporting or causing a fuss with their employer because they may lose their job if they do. So, I mean, it's kind of mixed. Now I'm going to say our governor did an amazing job through all this. She had a backbone of steel, and when they came after her, she stood strong. She went way over and above the call of duty to protect working people in this state and did the right thing. And look where our numbers have come down compared to a whole lot of other states. The governor deserves an awful lot of credit for everything that we've done to protect workers in the state. When people were on the Capitol lawn with guns and hanging her in effigy and all kinds of signs and nasty stuff about her and threats, I mean, it's amazing.
Ron, I also wanted to ask you about your membership and the slow movement, it seems, toward union members supporting Republicans in general and Trump in particular. Would you acknowledge that this is indeed happening, and what is that a bad thing?
What do you mean by slow movement towards it?
Well, we were seeing more in the way of polling that union members are supporting Republicans more than maybe they have in years past, and Trump in particular.
Well, I don't think that's going to hold up. You know, if it was in a normal year, we probably would have been out there communicating more face to face with our members than what we've been able to this time. We've got time yet, and we'll get our message out on the truth about Trump. And the truth is, Donald Trump has broken all his promises. He had promises to protect Michigan from plant closings. Well, guess what? We had plant closings and lost thousands of manufacturing jobs since Trump took office, thousands in Michigan. And where's the infrastructure bill? Everybody knows we need to fix the roads in Michigan. Where's the bill? This from the president who claimed he was a builder who knew how to make a deal. Where's the deal on infrastructure? Nothing. 3.5 years or 3.75 years, whatever it's been, nothing on that. So I don't think we're going to have a problem with our members. We just need to get the information to them so that they can make an informed choice. And once they do, or once they get the real information on Trump, I believe that we'll do very well with our members voting for Joe Biden.
Were there any policies that in the last 3.5 years that he pursued trade-wise that you like? Maybe steel tariffs or reforming NAFTA into the new... Is there anything there that was good for the working person?
I'll say this first about the new NAFTA. The final bill was not Trump's bill. Trump had a bill that he was done with. He was done with the package. He was done with the new trade, USMCA. He was good with it. That trade bill had no protections for workers in it. It was Nancy Pelosi and the congressional Democrats who had backbones of steel and said, no, that's not good enough. There's not protections in there for workers, and they're the ones who stood strong and got the protections for workers in that agreement. So Donald Trump may want to take credit for that new NAFTA replacement, but he didn't do it. That the bill that was final was not his doing. And even though it's not perfect, it's got protections for workers that we didn't have before. And the jury's still out. Time will tell. But we lost auto jobs under Trump in Michigan. And the steel workers in E-Course are losing their jobs because of his failed strategy with all this trade stuff. The problem with his trade deals are it's too erratic. And, you know, right after NAFTA, then he put out more tariffs on our friends. So you had Canada doing retaliatory tariffs on us, and it's just too erratic. He's not stable enough. He doesn't manage stable enough or make decisions straight or stable enough to live up to his promises, and it's just not a good deal for America. When he does get tough, he attacks our allies, like I said, and then this erratic nature, this swinging back and forth with no strategy, doesn't help Michigan workers.
What have you sensed is different about this campaign than maybe others that you've seen outside of maybe something related to COVID, as far as maybe the technology or the way the people are talking or the way people are communicating? What have you sensed being different this time around?
Well, that is the biggest difference in my mind. I mean, who would ever thought we'd had national conventions with no people in a packed arena, right? Or it's different. I mean, we're not going on door to door like we usually do. And we usually send armies out going door to door. We may do that yet. I mean, we've got time. There's 60 days or whatever before the election. So we may do it still, but it's a morphed election into a new way with new technology. I'm old school. I want to be out there banging on doors and talking to people face to face. So it's a little tougher for me, but I'll tell you, the younger people, it seems like normal to them. They'd rather be communicating virtually or on their computers or with pop-up ads and all that kind of stuff. That's not what works for me. So I think that's been the biggest change. Now, what will the rest of this campaign look like? I don't know. And, you know, no big rallies and that kind of stuff. It's different.
Yeah. It's kind of almost feel a little lonely, doesn't it? I mean, having all that kind of interaction, you know, especially at the Democratic convention, you know, seeing old friends and seeing old faces, and it's got to feel really weird.
That's a good way to put it, Kyle. I hadn't thought of it like that, but it is lonely. I mean, it's not, you know, I enjoy it. I get around, get in front of a lot of crowds, and it's not just the going to a rally and speaking to a crowd. It's afterwards or beforehand, talking to all the people. I love that. I love talking to workers and getting to, you know, hear from them what their issues are, and it keeps you connected better. The lonely is a good word. It's a lonely campaign. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Well, I only think of that from covering the legislature and in the times when I go to the House floor or the Senate floor, and I got to sit up in the balcony now. I can't be on the actual floor. And, you know, lawmakers have masks on, and there's no lobbyists around to mingle with. You know, the staff has pretty much disappeared. And, yeah, it just kind of feels like a ghost town in the Capitol. And I'm just kind of looking and thinking about it in the campaign sense. And, you know, I don't get out and meet people like y'all do. And I just got to believe it's a very similar experience.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. There is not as much, you know, face-to-face interaction. I'll tell you a quick story. In 2012, this is why I love Joe Biden. In 2012, Joe Biden came to Michigan, and he was having a rally-type thing somewhere in the Detroit area. Anyway, I was at the UAW at the time and was their political director. Out of the blue, here comes this message. Joe Biden would like to sit down and talk to some local union officials. Well, you know, that doesn't happen very often. Usually it's the higher-ups, right, who end up in a room with him. But he didn't want any of those. He wanted to talk to grassroots leaders. So we got eight leaders together from plants, and then there was me that was like, you know, the facilitator or whatever. He was supposed to be 45 minutes. 45 minutes came and went in a second. And Joe Biden sat there and said, tell me what's going on with your members. Tell me what's going on in your industry. Tell me what your issues are. And he listened and listened and listened, and then he talked. And I had a lot of friends who were over at the rally. I was texting them saying, you're going to be waiting a few minutes because the 45 minutes came and went. I think we were in there like 2 hours.
No way.
It was the most amazing thing I've seen in my time in politics. The guy cared. The guy listened, and it was just incredible. He's got an incredible knowledge of the auto industry. But he wanted to listen. He wanted to learn to these frontline leaders. It was pretty remarkable.
One last question here before we let you go. So what do you think the winning message is going to be for the Democrats this year?
That's a good question. I think it's still economics. I mean, we've lost a lot of jobs. It is, you know, there's a great debate. Do you talk about Trump? Do you not talk about Trump? I don't think you can help but talk about Trump, because it's his ineptitude, it's his bungling of this COVID crisis that caused the economic troubles that we're in. So I want to be clear about this. The virus isn't Trump's fault, but the absolute failure to have a plan to confront it is. And the numbers and the devastation that it's had on working families because of that in Michigan is horrific. So I think it's going to be, you know, getting back to normal. Joe Biden will bring this country together. That I don't know about everybody else, but I can't take it anymore. This division, this constant fighting and you know, just people being split up so left or right or whatever we're split up about, Joe Biden can bring people together. I think people want to return to normalcy, and Joe Biden will bring that. We are never going to get that with Donald Trump as president, but I think with Trump's record's clear, and that's what I meant earlier about once we get our information out about Donald Trump's real record and not the rhetoric that he's putting out, our members are going to understand what's in their best interest, and they'll vote for Joe Biden and Democratic ticket.
Ron Bieber, he's the president of AFL-CIO here in Michigan. Thank you so much for taking time with us today on our Labor Day edition of the podcast.
Thanks, Kyle, and happy Labor Day.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Brock Schwartzel for coming in, and also thanks to Ron Bieber. And John, as I'm looking out the window here and recording it, I'm seeing the rain falling. If you know, I don't know if the thunder, I'm going to listen to this podcast later, see if the thunder is coming through on this recorder like the murmur of the lawnmower at MERS World Headquarters. But I guess if you can't have outdoor sound when you do these podcasts, then, you know, why not, right? I mean, you got to have some ambiance, I suppose.
You should start up a lawnmower.
A lawnmower in the thunderstorm.
Yeah, there you go.
Double
I
background.
I opened the door, but you wouldn't hear anything here. There's no wind, there's no rain, it's blue skies.
Oh, yeah. Well, a little different situation here.
I'll throw this out for Beau Lefebvre. It's always better in the UP.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, so in the last podcast, that reminds me. Last podcast, you know how I lamented that I couldn't go over the Mackinac Bridge anymore on my bike. And Bo sent me a text message. He said that if I didn't mind sitting next to his dog, he could throw my bike in the back of his vehicle. So that's an option, he told me. Yeah, so that's an option. And then Jack told
me
today.
I'm sure he'd be there for you.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he would, as long as I give him quarter of the day. And then Jack, sorry, Bo, that was just too easy. And then Jack, I know Bo listens, so. And then Jack, He told me today, because we talked about stories, and he told me, you know, Kyle, what you could do is you could just take the ferry over to Mackinac Island with your bike and then go from Mackinac Island to St. Ignace, and then that way you wouldn't even have to rely on anybody.
Exactly. I never thought of that. That's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you, and then I could take the ferry to Drummond Island, so if you hear somebody knocking on your door and you don't see a vehicle pull up, who knows? Maybe I've made it all the way to Drummond Island.
Yeah. Maybe. It's either going to be you or the bear family that keeps coming around.
I think I'd be less scary. How about that? Thanks to AT&T. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Moon. Take care.